whether your title is a salesperson or not, I mean, people buy from people they trust, like, and know. And most people have it reversed, Matthew. They say, oh, we gotta, you know, people have to know you and then they like you and then they trust you. And I go, no. It starts at the gut level, which is, do I trust you? And you're being authentic. In fact, that was where a handshake came from, was to show I don't have a weapon, I'm not gonna hurt you. And then it moves from the gut to the heart, which is, do I like you? Right? And the best way to increase your likability is to show empathy, put yourself in the other person's shoes. And then it moves to the head. Will this work for me? Can I see myself in that story? Are these the people that could solve my problem? So it's gut, heart, head. And that is how you get people to want to buy from you and go from just being interesting up to irresistible.
You're listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
Well, I can't tell you how delighted I am to have you on my humble Hooked on Startups podcast. So, you know, John, welcome.
Thank you, Matthew. It's great to be here. You're a charming person and I'm sure an equally charming host from the other episodes I've watched and listened
to. That's very, very kind. And that, we're definitely not chopping that bit out in the edits, I can tell you. Well, let me, now the problem is, see, John, you run a fabulous bureau. I'm going to probably ruin... And you're going to teach me why I'm ruining. And that's the whole purpose of this.
Okay.
I'm going to use your words. I'm going to cheat. I'm going to introduce you.
Yes.
And I'm going to read this so I don't completely ruin it. But so, John, you're known as the pitch whisperer. And this is not something that you've called yourself. I mean, some very large, you know, TV stations came up with that name for you. So you're an author, you're a sales coach, and you work with tech CEOs looking for VC money. And you've appeared on all sorts of TV channels, CBS, Fox, ABC, and you're the expert on how to ask for what you want and get a yes. And you have this fantastic way of describing what you do, which is you make the invisible irresistible.
Yes, I help people go from being invisible to their ideal client to going to irresistible. So.
And that's a real challenge. And it's fascinating reading all about your background because you started off, you had this stellar background in advertising and media. You were with Condé Nast and there was another massive, The Daily Beast, which is a fantastic name.
Yes.
It sounds like something out of a Marvel comic.
Well, it is from a book, actually. Tina Brown was the editor at a lot of Condé Nast titles like Vanity Fair and The New Yorker. And then she joined forces with Barry Diller to launch The Daily Beast. And it's based, that title came from a book where it was a journalist who was, you know, getting the scoop. And so that's what she wanted The Daily Beast website to be doing.
And so your role is a very undervalued word, but what you did there is you basically ran sales, advertising, marketing. So the lifeblood of all of these journals, magazines is advertising revenue. So it was your...
For the LA office, yes. Not for the whole country, but my chunk of it was LA, which was usually a big part of the total sales, yes.
And is that where you sort of discovered that there was a way to communicate with the people that works and there's a way that doesn't work?
Yes. Well, when I was at Condé Nast, my job was to take multiple brands and titles, Wired, GQ, Vanity Fair, W, Vogue, etc., and figure out which each of those brands have a voice and an editor that creates that voice. And I would be going to brands like Lexus or Guess Jeans to say to them, here's what all the different brands and voices of these brand titles have across print, digital, and video. And how do we package what you're communicating, Lexus, for example, to that audience for this particular launch of a model, and what's the best combination to reach your ideal audience? So I had to understand all those brands voices, as well as what Lexus's message was for a particular launch of a new model, and see what combination of platforms and what combination of brands would ideally get them their ideal target to test drive that car.
And was this an approach that was different to the approach that was taken by your predecessors? Was there a moment where you thought, hang on, the normal way of trying to get sales just doesn't seem to be working? Was there a discovery moment?
The traditional way of calling on an advertising agency in particular is all about numbers, right? It's like, this is the combined reach of all these brands, and how much does it cost per thousand to reach them? And I would go in with a story, right? Imagine if we got Lexus to be perceived as an emotionally engaged brand like BMW is, by doing these kind of events and creating an ad that would surprise people. Where I was at the Daily Beast, we had the Lexus car driving across the screen. And back then, that hadn't been done before. So it caught your attention. It wasn't just a boring banner ad. It literally, rode across the screen. So we would create events and ways to get people's attention that would tug at their heartstrings. And that has really been my secret sauce to being successful in anything, is when you're telling stories instead of numbers, people remember your story, not your numbers. And really identifying what Lexus's challenge was, and in this case it was, people buy a BMW emotionally and buy a Lexus rationally, and they wanted to change that.
And is that something that, the reason I'm sort of exploring this is because I think these things, they don't come out of nowhere. I mean, this amazing skill that you have, which is to understand how to tell stories so that people remember you, so that things resonate with you. Is that a process of you start with this germ of an idea and then you try all these different approaches? And so how do you know the reasons behind some approaches working and some that don't work?
Well, not everything works and not everyone, reacts the same way. So it is definitely your own little mini focus group and your own little test. Right. I mean, it goes back to neuro-linguistic programming, which is some people are visual, some people are auditory, and some people are kinesthetic and very feeling oriented. But the storytelling element of it all fits all three of those because it's in our DNA. We used to sit around the glow of campfires and tell stories. And now we sit around the glow of PowerPoint presentations. But if you put your empathy hat on for the people sitting through pitch after pitch, whether it's a pitch to get funded, a pitch to hear from a magazine rep of why they should run their ads in their magazine, or if you're trying to get someone to buy what you're selling, it just all starts to blur together and it all starts to sound alike. The only differentiation is the storytelling. So Plato said storytellers rule the world. Yeah. And so my personal mission is to help as many people as possible become master storytellers. Because when that happens, they no longer have to push their sales message. They pull people in with a good story.
And I think also, but this had extraordinary success for you. So this isn't something that you tried with limited success. Because again, looking at your profile, time after time with W Magazine and the Daily Beast and with Condé Nast, best salesman. So these techniques that you've developed or that you've synthesized, mm-hmm. They work in scale.
They do, yes. And the good news is anyone can learn how to become a master storyteller. And once you've figured out what a good story is, how to tell a good story, and figure out what your story is, then your business can be equally successful. And I love giving keynote talks to companies on how to just do that. I was working with a big brand, Gensler, which is the world's largest architecture design firm. And they were going in and they had me come in and give a keynote talk on getting to yes. They had a whole retreat on how do we have better relationships with our clients. And we're making a lot. They have major clients like Facebook and Mercedes-Benz and banks and all this great stuff and skyscrapers in Dubai. And they would just go in typically and have a presentation where they would show their designs and hope that whoever had the best design would get hired. And after they heard my keynote speech on getting to yes and getting people emotionally involved with what they're doing and not talking about the square footage and the carpet size and fabric stuff, that they realized that they needed to become storytellers to get people to hire them. They build airports, for God's sakes. And that's a multi-million dollar situation. And I was called in to help them win a big job on an airport because they were told, we're going to work with people we like. It's a 5-6 year, not who has the best design. And so those soft skills of storytelling, confidence, empathy, likability is really a key skill that I bring to big brands that have all the hard skills already and just need to learn how to incorporate both.
And I think this has changed because when I was 21, my first job was with Pitney Bowes. And I still remember the training. And we had 2 or 3 weeks of fantastic training in the UK. And it was all about features, functions, benefits. Features, functions, benefits. And it was there was no discussion of empathy, right, emotion, of connection. It was, you go through rote, you describe the features, and we always used to have to say at the end, which means that.
Yes.
And so, but, and how has this changed? Because,
well, you know, it's funny because when you tell a really good story, like the selling skills of, you know, here's the case study, right? I mean, if you really got sophisticated beyond just the feature and benefits, because there's different levels of sophistication. There's people who just sell the features and don't even sell the benefits. So obviously that training sets you apart from some people. And then they go up the next rung of the ladder. So if we're going back to going from invisible, where they don't even know who you are or your brand, and then you go up to insignificant, which in the dating world, it's very similar, right? You see somebody you're attracted to, nobody, and then they see you, but you're insignificant. And the same thing is true in the whatever you're selling. That's horrible. Then if you can get to interesting, when you start the bare minimum of saying a benefit statement, like what this means to you is, that's interesting, but that's usually not enough to get a date or get a sale. And maybe in the old days it was.
Yes.
But then you get to intriguing and then finally irresistible. And that's where all the soft skills of storytelling and empathy and compassion and likability come into play. So some people say, well, you know, you probably should give a case study, which sounds equally boring. But that's a story of someone who was in the exact same position you were in before they used our product or service. And what they found is once they did it, their life took on a whole new meaning. They were less stressed out. They saved time. They saved money, whatever the outcomes are. But the key then, the really sophisticated storytelling is, how do I tell that story of another airport, for example, if we're back on the Gensler example, that did another airport design, and how that got all kinds of publicity for that airport, got their rankings up. They were able to tell a story of taking up all the floors in the middle of the night so that the retailers didn't lose any money during the day when the airport was open for passengers, right? Dramatic, there's a, you know, cliffhanger, they're gonna make that deadline, you know, the visuals of all that happening. When the potential customer client can see themselves in your story, then they go, oh, I wanna go on that same journey. Where you've got my back, or and now I see my, so that's very sophisticated storytelling, which then allows people to go, I want, that's for me. So not only do they remember it, but they're in the story, and that's all the difference in the world that never was taught before.
And I think that's another very important point. It's about what is taught. So I think we're touching on sort of the areas of emotional intelligence as opposed to So that's one area. But this isn't anything new. As you say, Plato talks about storytelling, and he's been around quite a while, I understand.
Yes.
But it's just this technique. And how do you get over this initial, what sort of resistance do you get from people saying, well, this is some kind of, you know, mumbo jumbo technique, as it were?
Well, I get them to agree on that there's a problem. What you're doing isn't working anymore, is it? Your sales staff is burnt out by just hammering features and benefits over and over again, and you're being perceived as a commodity, and clients aren't staying loyal. Are those your problems? If yes to any of them, I can help you. And they go, okay, now we're interested, right? We know we need to practice more. We need to connect, you know, we need to create ourselves as not a commodity. We need to emotionally engage with people so that we are liked and not just somebody who serves a need. And once that happens, that storytelling is the way to do it, then all these people out there that don't even want to think of themselves as salespeople, architects, they go, oh, well, I can think of myself as a storyteller and not a salesperson. Now you really have me.
And I think that is a critical point. not only is everything you're doing backed up by significant scientific research, and we can come on to that, mm-hmm. in terms of how people are engaging, talking to an emotional state as opposed to an adult state. Mm-hmm. And that's relatively new psychology. But also, I think the critical thing that you do is you enable people who hate the idea of being a salesperson.
Yes.
You allow them to flourish. You allow them to bloom, to be who they are.
Yes.
So how critical is it that people are genuine and are able to transmit this heartfelt storytelling?
Whether your title is a salesperson or not, people buy from people they trust, like, and know. And most people have it reversed, Matthew. They say, oh, we got to, you know, people have to know you and then they like you and then they trust you. And I go, no. It starts at the gut level, which is, do I trust you? And you're being authentic. In fact, that was where a handshake came from, was to show I don't have a weapon. I'm not going to hurt you. And then it moves from the gut to the heart, which is, do I like you? Right? And the best way to increase your likability is to show empathy, put yourself in the other person's shoes. And then it moves to the head. Will this work for me? Can I see myself in that story? Are these the people that could solve my problem? So it's gut, heart, head. And that is how you get people to want to buy from you and go from just being interesting up to irresistible.
And do you find that most of the people that your clients are selling to, are they naturally willing to listen to stories? Yeah. Or is this... because the perception is that there's always a resistance to being sold to.
Yeah, it's
nice. I don't want to have another salesman, but.
Exactly. Well, it's left brain, right brain. So if I say I'm going to give you something to analyze, numbers, then you cross your arms. You're like, all right, let's see what you got, right? But if I say, let me tell you a story, your arms unfold. You're like, oh, good. Maybe this will be interesting and maybe even entertaining. And through that story, you're on a journey. And if it's a good story and the person's a good storyteller, there's a little bit of suspense, there's a little bit of obstacles to overcome, and there's some kind of life lessons that happen. And, you know, people buy emotionally, as we said, and that's a right brain thing. That's where imagination lives. So if you think to yourself, if you're trying to sell a Ferrari, you don't talk about miles per gallon, that's left brain. You say you're going to look so hot and sexy in that car, and you're going to feel like $1 million, you're going to feel like you're 21 again. And then, oh, by the way, you know, here's the left brain stuff, right? But you buy emotionally first and then back it up with logic. Even buying a home is an emotional decision first and then backed up with logic.
Because I can imagine some of the engineers in Gensler who would normally be very reserved people,
yeah,
becoming some of your best sales guys because of the love that they have for the product that they're doing.
Yes. Well, you know, here's an example. Everybody has to, you know, talk about the team, right? If you hire us, here's who you get to work with. And before working with me, it would sound, you know, very much like they're, and I don't know, some kind of academic presentation. My name is George. I've been here 10 years. My responsibilities are A, B, and C. Now I pulled stories out of each of them. It's like, you know, when I was 11 years old, I played with Legos. And that's what inspired me to become an architect. And now I have a son that's 11 and I still play with Legos. And I still have that same passion that I'm going to bring to your project of being an architect. Now meet Sue. She's the best at what we have at making sure that things get done on time. Before working here, I was in the Israeli army. And I make sure I bring that same discipline and focus I learned there to making sure your project comes on time and under budget. Well, guess who they hired?
Well, I want to hear more.
Yeah.
And I honestly, because you do, people want to hear about how did you build this thing? I know I'm sitting across the boardroom table with my suit and my stern face, but emotionally, if you start talking about how you were in the Israeli army or how, tell me about your son building stuff in Lego, I want to know more and I want to connect with you.
So that storytelling of why you and why now and what we would, and then they hear other pitches before and after Gensler. Well, they remembered the Gensler team. Oh, let's get those people that the guy plays with Legos with his son and the other person on his team was in the Israeli army. I think they really would be people that we would like working with, and their designs are great too, of course. Otherwise, they wouldn't have even been invited in. But that's really the secret sauce.
And I think that's a critical thing because it's not about the designs. It's about, okay, everyone has the same brilliant designs. Like everyone has a fabulous idea, but can I work with you? Can I connect with you as a person? And what you're doing is you're enabling people to show their humanity, which is really what people want to, nobody wants to go to work and work with people they don't like.
or that aren't interested in them, right? It's just another project to them versus we care about you. When I can get the potential client to say to my clients, you get us after we heard the pitch, then I know they're going to get the sale because that's the intriguing level, right? And so the typical, let's give your listeners something not to do, right? Which when you open a pitch, if you're invited into pitch for anything,
yeah,
45 minutes, whatever, 10 minutes, whatever it is, don't open with, thank you so much, I'm excited to be here. Boring, everyone says it, it's not memorable, it's not sincere, and no one cares that you're excited. It's not about you. So the Gensler opening sounded something like, your CEO has tasked you from getting this airport ranked from number 24 to number one in 5 years. We have just the right team to do it because we've done it for other airports in other countries, and we're excited to make you achieve your goal. That's the opening to the 45 minutes, as opposed to thank you so much for this opportunity. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, you're right. Because the thank you thing, as you say, everyone says that. And it's also, it kind of puts you on the back foot because it's almost like, thank you so much for, you know, giving me this, I'll be really quick. I'll get it over and done with. And then I'll be out of your boardroom. I promise. So just bear with me for, and when people use phrases like, you know, bear with me. And,
No. It's you're interviewing them as much as they're interviewing you. And it should be a collaborative conversation because that's how you're going to work together, ideally. And who you say no to is just as important as who you say yes to. And so that concept of, we don't just work with everybody who wants to work with us. We're here because we think we could do a really good job, and we know we can solve your problems, or which is getting this, not just the airport renovated, but ranked higher on how much people love it and all the other evaluations that go into a good job. And sometimes, like when I've helped them win some law firms, you know, and sometimes it's about, how do we have a wow factor to attract our ideal clients, and how can design help us keep clients? And that becomes a whole other conversation.
And do you find that the moment that you unlock this confidence in people that they have these really interesting stories?
Oh yeah.
Do you find then that, that
people say, oh, I don't have any good stories. And I'm like, well, let me see if I can trigger some, right? It just for people that are watching and listening to us, if you think of your family, right? That's a core place for digging up good stories. Maybe a trip you went on, right? Maybe a product that you bought and why you bought it. All those kinds of things are just a great conversation starter to get you out of your head of, oh, I'm not interesting. I don't have any dramatic stories. And once you do, then people get a sense of who you are and why they want to work with you.
And there's this great phrase, which is imposter syndrome.
Yes. Oh, I just went through that with a client of mine, helping them get over that imposter syndrome. First of all, realize almost everybody has it. And the premise around the imposter syndrome is you're comparing yourself to somebody else, right? And I have a whole thing about focus on your own progress and you win, right? I used to swim competitively, and there's a guy that always beat me, and you touch the wall and measures your time to the thousands of a second. And I did that, and they said, oh my God, you beat him by half a second. I'm like, how'd that happen? They said, well, you stayed focused on the wall and he turned his head to the right to see if he was ahead of you or not. And that half a second of turning caused him to lose. So then I went, oh, and I started looking at people who stay focused on being the best they can be and not comparing themselves to other people ultimately win. So the imposter syndrome comes from us getting all nervous about, do people like me? Am I good enough? Are people going to judge me? And I just say, take your nervousness into service, nerves into serve. I'm here to help and serve, not I'm not here to get people to love me or judge me. And once you get out of your own head of, am I good enough? And just trust that you're getting there, you know, and you want to be both scared and excited.
Yes.
And I think if you're just scared, that means you're not prepared. And if you're just excited, it means you're not taking it seriously enough.
Yes.
But if you're both, you're in the right space. You should feel a little scared and a little excited when you're pitching or getting a new opportunity to do something outside your comfort zone.
But if we take, so a lot of work that you do is with early stage companies looking to raise money from VCs.
Yep.
So do you get the opposite problem there where you've got the founder who knows everything, has put this 40-slide presentation together that covers everything the VC could ever possibly want to know. And the moment you start saying, listen, we probably need to think about this, rather than being the imposter syndrome, he's the opposite. He's the guy that knows everything.
Yes. Well, I typically don't work with those people.
No, that's it. That solves that problem then. Yes.
But I've seen it. And I just say to them, look, unless you're coachable, I'm not a good fit for you. And guess what? Investors aren't going to invest in you either. They want confidence, but not arrogance, Matthew. And sometimes they will ask you a question during your pitch or after your pitch just to see how you respond to being pressured, because you cannot get defensive. And anybody who pretends to know everything, people think they know nothing, right? And you know what they're looking for is tenacity, but also with some ability to take some input in. And this whole concept of trying to explain everything, you know, the investors say, don't try to boil the ocean.
Yes, which is a great expression that, funny enough, I use quite a lot, because you know there are people that want to be all things to all people. And do you see that? Because your coaching extends far beyond looking at documents and saying, well, take this slide out and take that slide out and change this image. What you do is you go right to the core of who that person is and how they project themselves.
Well, that's one of the things investors say to startups. We invest in the jockey, not the horse.
Yeah.
And so many people make the mistake of thinking, my idea is so great, they're going to give me money to fund this app or whatever it is. And I'm like, no, they're investing in you. And that's for why your team side is so important. You need to explain why you're uniquely qualified to execute the idea and why now is the perfect time to make this happen.
Yes, no, you're absolutely right. Because one of the other guys that I interviewed a while back, very senior guy at Intuit, the big takeaway from that was when they're looking at new projects or new teams, it's that flexibility. It's the ability for the person to take on things that they weren't expecting and to deal with those things in a where there's a positive outcome. So,
and there's where a story comes in, right? So if you can tell a story of when you were at another startup or at your current startup and things weren't going well and you had to figure out how to pivot on limited resources and you made it happen, that's much more memorable than just saying, I worked here and did this.
And you said earlier about things that you shouldn't say. Mm. Are there some rule of thumb?
Oh, yes, let's go over quickly. Never say you don't have any competition. That means you don't have a market. Never say if we only get 1% of the population, we'll be rich. That's a top-down strategy. People want a bottom-up strategy. Never ask an investor to sign a non-disclosure agreement. They're not interested in stealing your ideas. And don't have too many words on your pitch deck slide. That's a common, common mistake. And for God's sakes, don't read your slides.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen that before where someone puts a slide up and then just reads it. And you think, well, I am uniquely qualified to understand your business because I too can read your slides.
Yeah, it's horrible. It's the kiss of death. You bore people instantly and they tune out.
But is there something that you would say you really should say in the first few minutes?
Probably seconds, yes. It's all about our brains are wired to crave new information. And so you need to get them to, for example, if I was pitching myself as if I was an investor, I'll say, you know how everybody needs a good elevator pitch and few people have one? And people go, oh yeah. I'm the pitch whisperer. I help people go from invisible to irresistible. And when that happens, their business takes off. And you're like, oh, that's interesting. And then it's just enough to get people to say, well, what's a pitch whisperer? Or how do you do that?
Tell me more.
Tell me more. Yeah. And that's what the whole thing is. So I was just helping someone get funded and they were saying, you know, did you know that the rise in shootings in schools has gone up 50% in the last 3 years? And if that's not bad enough, the way people are solving it is the parents are calling each other on some kind of antiquated phone tree log. And then when the police or the SWAT team get there, they don't know where to go and they're wasting time at the front desk. Well, Imagine if there was a platform that could instantly notify first responders and parents in seconds instead of minutes, give a color-coded floor plan so the SWAT team doesn't waste time and help solve these problems and give people peace of mind. Well, you don't have to imagine it because we've created it at Trezit. And then you start telling your story. Well, that's
because I'm holding that. I've got that image. And there's a certain amount of time that I'll hold that image and wait for you to explain because now I'm on the hook. I was reading the other day about, is it the reticular something or other? I have to Google this and insert it in the show notes. But the idea is that the brain is programmed to look for stuff that moves. Things, ideas, things that's moving, because we want to know what is it.
And as statistics that we haven't heard, or putting words together, like our friend Sam Morris, he's the Zen warrior.
Yes.
Whisperer. Those are combinations of words that you haven't heard before. I know what a horse whisperer is. What's a pitch whisperer? And so your brain goes, wait a minute, that's new. And we pay attention to shiny new things that we hear or see. And so that's what you need to do to pull people in the first 90 seconds.
Because it's not easy raising capital from VCs. Let's just talk about your experience in the trenches with good companies, investable companies that have worked with you.
Well, another example of that kind of statistic would be, did you know that only 1% of pitches get funded? Investors hear about 2,500 pitches in a year and fund 25. And 24 of those 25 come from a warm introduction. Well, imagine if there was a way to get you with the right pitch in the right room and get you with that warm introduction. Well, you don't have to imagine it, because that's what I do for startups to help them get funded fast.
Because, and again, so it's not, and so I'm just trying to just get across this, the scope of what you do, because it is a real grassroots re-engineering of how the people think of themselves, how they sort of present themselves to other people, but also your connections to VC. So you have a whole bunch of people that are there contacting you on a regular basis saying, you know,
bring me good deals.
What have you got?
Somebody that's engaged with you and has been trained by you on how to have a good pitch, and they are doing something in the niche that we invest in, please make those intros. So it's the, once you have a good pitch, you need to get in the right room. And so I do those kinds of connections for my clients all the time.
But again, the pitch is, so the problem with my understanding of the word pitch is it's quite a transitory word. You know, it sort of speaks to something that is short term. You have the pitch and then that goes away. But really what you're doing is you're training people to communicate.
Yes.
To communicate. And this is going to be critical for them as their business grows, because they're going to have to continue to communicate new ideas to their investors and their clients.
Well, when they're successful, they'll hit certain milestones and they'll need to get the next round of funding. And I tell them, you need to pitch to get the right people to join your team versus other startups. You need to pitch to get clients and customers that pay you, and you need to pitch to get investors. So if you can learn how to be a master storyteller, you'll be using that as a startup funder for your whole career.
And your skills, are they equally transferable to existing companies that are not startups, who are facing challenges from disruption or from market change?
Yes. In fact, that's one of my keynote talks, is how to deal with, embrace disruption instead of ignore it, so that you become Netflix instead of Blockbuster. And, you know, I just gave a keynote talk to KPBS down in San Diego, who has to raise $30 million to get a new building. I'm going to be speaking to Anthem Health Insurance about how to deal with the disruption happening in the health insurance world. And yet those people are not traditional salespeople, but there's money being left on the table with the contracts not being used. So whether that's, you know, an architecture firm, or you look at the car company, how that whole industry is being disrupted. And I've given talks to their dealers on how to engage with people and handle rejection. But that whole, you know, the whole world's being disrupted because young people today are not in any hurry to get a car, let alone a lot. Yeah. So how do you keep your business growing and deal with all that? And if cars are self-driving, then why do I ever need to buy my own car? So yes, it's a lot of brands that hire me to help them deal with disruption inside their industry, as well as then how do they handle their marketing and selling to get new clients.
And it's also, I guess, it's how do they maintain innovation within their teams? How do they communicate this idea? Because going back to the idea of your engineer at Gensler, who's suddenly discovered a whole new side to himself because he can explain the story, do you find that that's equally valuable internally?
Oh, yes. In fact, they actually had me come back and do an internal. There's a group of architects that are called the tech directors, and they're actually seen as the bearers of bad news all the time. So once Gensler would get a project, this is true of any architecture firm, the tech directors are the ones that the client goes, can we do this? And their instant response is no. because of X, Y, and Z from a technical reason. They're just not thinking in terms of empathy or, you know what, we can't do that, but let me think about how we can come up with another solution, right? Getting to yes. So they had me help them, the whole division of the team, figure out how they could be part of the pitch, because now they're not taking on the pitches. And secondly, how they could change their internal branding from the bearers of gloom and doom to people who are solution people, as opposed to people who just say no.
And who do you work with most? So aside from the small startups where you'll be working, I guess, directly with the founders, in companies like Gensler and these larger organizations, who do you typically work with?
Well, it's the people who are responsible for winning new business and keeping new business, right? So that's, you know, the VP of marketing, you know, the regional, you know, co-managers, people who have a stake in the company's revenue growth.
And again, from an HR perspective, again, as well, there's all sorts of overlaps there, because if you're bringing the ability to make people more in love with their job and more satisfied with what they're doing.
Yes. In fact, some of the feedback from the people at Gensler were they felt so thrilled that Gensler had hired me to come train them on these storytelling techniques so that they could become better communicators internally within the company, that then those people become more engaged and more loyal. Because if the company invests by hiring people like me to come and help the people get skills that make them a better person to communicate that applies across all areas of their lives, then the people feel like the company really cares about them. And that's the key secret to getting people to stay loyal to your company, and they won't jump at the next chance to make 10% more.
And you're right. So therefore, the return on investment, it's not just that immediate, you know, John is going to teach us how to get that deal or how to get that contract. It goes much deeper, because the changes that you make, you're actually re-educating people about how they think about themselves. You're getting them over these imposter syndrome fears. I mean, it's almost it's a seismic change that you're making to some of these organizations.
It's disruption in a good way. It's going from pushing your message and being pushy and being seen as the person who always says no and cranky, to pulling people in and being seen as somebody people want to hang out with and collaborate with.
And I think the most beautiful thing about this in the true sense is that this is something that you have created yourself through years of trying different approaches and, you know, pointing sticks at different buttons, trying to make them work. So, you know, this isn't something that you've borrowed from someone's book and are just regurgitating it.
No, it's not just theory. I've actually been in the audience's shoes, right? I've been calling on multiple different kinds of categories of cars and luxury and design and hotels and fashion and tech, and understanding how to take tech concepts and explain it in a way that you don't have to understand AI to invest in that AI concept, artificial intelligence. So yes, it is years of figuring out what works and having done it. And that's my big differentiation, even as myself as a brand and as a speaker, is it's not just theory, it's actual things, stories that work, and here's how you can use those stories to grow your business.
Amazing. So it's that ability to get the left brain talking to the right brain, I guess.
Yes, and a lot of times in companies, there's people who are one more than the other, and when they all can start, the right brain people can start appreciating some of the tech number stuff instead of resenting it, and the left brain people can start tapping into their own storytelling imagination concepts and showing a little empathy, then everybody's meeting in the middle, and that's when the magic happens.
And particularly where, you know, because we're all based out on the West Coast, so we have some amazing stories with companies like Apple and Steve Jobs, and who create, and Nolan Bushnell, for example, who within Atari and Apple, they create this environment where people are not afraid to, are very proud of what they do. Mm-hmm. I remember in Nolan Bushnell's book, Finding Another Steve Jobs, he talks about how engineers would demand to stay and sleep overnight because they were so committed. So do you find that you're able to start connecting these disparate departments within?
Well, I don't think anybody wants to stay overnight, but I can definitely
team. We can work towards that.
Yes, to be passionate about their why. And that I have people zoom out, right? What is it that I'm doing that fits into the bigger picture that then makes an impact on the clients that are paying us to do that? So one of the stories that I was able to pull out of the team at Gensler on a law firm redesign when they were pitching another law firm was, you know, when we were taking the law firm on the tour after we had done all of our changes, One woman's eyes filled up with tears because she realized that she was going to be able to work in a space that had light. She was And before, she had been in a dark hallway for the whole shift of 10 hours or whatever it was, being, you know, the paralegal legal assistant. And, you know, no matter who you are, how high you up, you know, if your support team is happy, your life is completely different. And just that little story of somebody being so happy that they were so grateful that they could see the sunlight through the design is much more compelling than just, we put windows in.
Yeah. No, of course. But being the person, it must be amazing just to see that turnaround when you're talking to people and saying, look, you're a brilliant engineer. If you just said it like this, or if you just tell me that story again about that and seeing that sort of metamorphosis of the person's face as they go from this dour engineer to this electric character who's in love with his job.
Yeah, they light up. And then right before they go into pitch to get the business, they're feeling more confident, they're more prepared, and they are more cohesive as a team. And that whole energy that happens time and time again is so gratifying to me, because I know I'm making a difference to help them make a difference. And then it just keeps being paid forward, which is really what we all want. We want to feel like we make a difference in what we're doing. And that's why I'm so passionate about what I do. And people can usually pick that up. And that's, you know, half of why they're hiring me to come give a talk or train them on how to pitch better is they're like, you really love this, don't you? And I go, I do.
And I think that's so important, because that energy is something that you can't pretend to have that enthusiasm. It's a raw material that has so far been, you know, impossible to reproduce.
I was talking to one organization when they were in the process of hiring me to be their keynote speaker. And I said, well, imagine we're having a conversation a week after the event. What would you be hearing? What would it sound like? We're going to have a recap. What would it look and feel like for me to not just done an okay job, but an exceptional job, go above and beyond? And they said, oh my gosh, I don't even know. We haven't even thought that far out. Or we don't really. And I said, well, here's what it feels like to me. I said, I gave a talk to KPBS, and they took the time to write a handwritten thank you note and had hundreds of people sign this huge card and mail it to me. Wow. That's when I know I did it above and beyond, right? And they're like, oh, got it. Well, maybe this person, my boss, would say good job to me. The people would say, oh my God, now I feel more confident to do this where I didn't before. Or now I really learned something that I can put into action right away. It wasn't just an inspirational talk. I learned some strategy. You start that conversation going, and that's why they hired me, right? Because you're future pacing people, which is just another strategy on having to get people to say why you.
Yes, which is, and again, it's almost like a magic formula, but it's within all of us. It's just telling people, what is the expression? You sort of teaching people to get out of their own way.
Yes. Well, you know, the interesting thing that happens is when you start having conversations with people and you get known for one thing, right? Don't try to boil the ocean. So I'm known as the pitch whisperer. Then other things come out of that. So if you're a startup, you have your startup, right? Be known for one thing. Amazon just sold books at first and then started other. So with me, people know me as the pitch whisperer. After they've engaged me as a keynote speaker and then I become their secret weapon for winning new clients, then it's morphed into, you know what? Do you have any experience in helping us win back a client we lost? Yeah. Well, yes, I do. And oh my God, you're like the cold case detective. We've got this whole list of clients we'd love to win back, but we don't know how to do it. And it's the same skill sets, right?
But all you're doing is you're just doing what you teach other people to do.
Yes. But they, you know, their way of doing it would be just to go, well, we're going to go in with research. I go, that's not going to win back anybody. They're mad. They don't feel listened to. You need to restore and rebuild the relationship first before they're willing to listen to any ideas. Oh, right? So all that gets healed and then they can listen. So that's really, there's a lot of different avenues, just like in a startup, that you can go, this is what I'm known for. And then people love me so much, they're going to ask me if I can do something else. And then startups love to go, yes, we also do that.
But that must be, I mean, that must be great for you, but also slightly frustrating when you go, well, I see all this I can do, but there's only one of me. So how do you, You know what I mean? How do you scale it? How do you build it so that there are people that can get in work with you, as it were, but without having to have the full, you know, and have the full-on consultancy, as it were?
Well, I mean, there's ways to create, you know, online courses and things like that for people. But my real passion is rolling up my sleeves and working with a few core people, whether it's a few core startups that need funding or, you know, giving these keynote talks and working with people. But Skype's been a huge help, right?
Yes.
I'm working with people literally around the world, London, Toronto, and that allows me to not have to travel so much. So that, unless they want me to come in for a keynote speech, but they just want me to coach them via Skype, that works really well for the pitch from the scalability thing.
Yes.
But I'm not trying to build an empire. I'm not trying to, you know, get an investor to give me $500,000 so I can get him a return on his investment in 3 to 5 years and scale my own business. I love what I do, and I love, you know, possibly training other people to help and go in and do it so it could scale that way. But for now, I'm just ecstatic to be the keynote speaker who makes impact that way.
And I think you're right. I think that's because the natural thing to do, to assume is you say, great, well, you've got something fantastic here, John. You know, we're going to scale it. We're going to have courses. We're going to have, you know, masterminds. But actually, what you're saying is I like the purity of just seeing that smile on people's faces. And because you lose that, I guess, if you become too disconnected.
Well, you know, it all depends what your objectives are, right? You know, if you want to make $1 million and you want to scale something and have all this stuff going on and not burn out. But I'm, you know, that's not where I am. I love the life of being a keynote speaker and then off doing workshops and then feed the few people that, you know, can hire me based on my availability of time. It, you know, it's supply and demand. And when you're known for getting great results, and like you said, the return on investment for hiring me as a speaker or hiring me to get you funded works, then I don't need to scale that because it's...
But I think you'd ruin it. You'd lose the magic. You'd lose that. But you can tell that there's real joy and passion in what you do. So I am... But anyway, look, I've got some questions for you. I have my magical questionnaire that I borrowed permanently from James Lipton of Inside the Actor Studio.
This is great for me because I've always wondered, what would I say? And now I get to answer.
Yeah, I just like another shout out to James. Thanks again for this. But so the first question is, what is your favorite word?
Yes.
And the second question is, what is your least favorite word?
Maybe.
Ah, not what I was expecting.
Maybe is much worse than no. If you give me a no, fantastic, I move on. The maybe drives me crazy because then I got to go, what's the objection? Is it you? Is it me? Is it not a fit? Is it just your fear? What's the problem here?
Very, absolutely right. You're right. You know, so clarity is much better than, you know, I can't be bothered to think about it. I'll tell you later sort of thing. Number three, what are you most excited about right now?
I'm most excited about being in the final consideration for giving a TEDx talk on how to navigate disruption in your personal life.
Wow, that's very exciting. Mm-hmm. And what turns you off right now?
Turns me off. People who insist they're right all the time.
I know what you mean. So what sound or noise do you love?
The sound of my dog playing with each other and making playful noise.
And what sound or noise do you hate?
Any living creature that's in pain.
Yes, I know. I can subscribe to that one. And what is your favorite curse word?
Shit.
That is what, you know, these great four-letter words are just so flexible. I mean, I love that too. What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Professional photographer.
Oh, wow. Brilliant. And what profession would you not like to attempt?
Oh my God, there's so many. I think garbage man is at the top.
I mean, a refuse technician, I think they're called.
Yeah.
And the final question, if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Welcome home.
Well, John, thank you for being such a brilliant guest. My final question is how, you know, you're going to have to get some new servers because they're clearly going to be knocked over. But how do people find out more about you? How do they get hold of you?
Sure. JohnLivesay.com, which is my website, has my podcast that you can listen to, The Successful Pitch. You can just Google The Pitch Whisperer and all my stuff comes up. On Twitter, it's @John_Livesay. And if anybody, you know, sends me an instant message on Twitter or to my email from my website, I'm happy to respond.
That's brilliant. Good. Well, look forward to speaking to you again, to seeing you again, and you know, and following your progress. So thanks once again for being on the show.
Pleasure, Matthew. Thanks for having me.